start a company or not, I ask, well, how angry and frustrated are you? Because you should start a company because you're really angry and frustrated with something in society. That's the number one, if that's the number one reason you should start a company. There's something about society that really frustrates you and that you want to fix it.
All right. So hello and welcome everyone to whoever's listening to this particular podcast. Today we have with us Charles Fisher. Charles is the CEO and founder of Unlearn.ai, which helps in faster drug development and efficient clinical trials. This year, they also raised a Series B funding of around $50 million, which is really commendable. And Charles also holds a PhD in biophysics from Harvard University. And prior to founding Unlearn, he did his postdoctorate at Boston University, followed by being a principal scientist at Pfizer, and also a machine learning engineer at a virtual reality company in Silicon Valley. So Charles, thanks for being on the podcast. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jay.
So you have a strong research background in biophysics. I'm curious, like, how did you first dabble with machine learning, and what was about machine learning that really got you interested in it?
Yeah, so it depends on what machine learning is. So kind of the answer to that. So I did my undergrad in biophysics and my PhD in biophysics. And one of the things about biophysics is that it's a field that it's not clear what it is. So biophysics means many things to many people. For myself, I focused on sort of theoretical and computational biophysics. So I was always doing computer modeling of things. And so the work that I did when I was doing my PhD, a lot of the work that we were doing was looking at protein folding, which of course now has become a big problem in AI, but at the time it was not. At the time, we would use these physics-based simulations. So you'd have positive charges, negative charges, you would describe how those interact with Coulomb's law, and you would run these simulations. And so you have all the atoms in the protein simulated. Those simulations don't work very well. So you could run them, but then you would calculate things from the experiments compared to experiment, and they didn't agree very well. So what we basically were thinking about with my PhD was saying, well, we can do these experiments and we get these data, and we have these molecular simulations that we can run. Is there some way we can combine that information? So we were thinking about, well, you could treat using different types of Bayesian methods. You could treat the molecular simulation as a prior. And then you have your experimental data and you update it to try to understand what it is you learn about the proteins and their behavior. And so that's the kind of work that I was working on. It's very computational. At the time, I was just writing all this C++ code to do Monte Carlo simulations. Like, that's my whole PhD, is writing C code to run Monte Carlo simulations. Because at the time, this is before there were all these nice tools that we have today. You had to write all the stuff yourself. So what happened is that kind of got retconned into being machine learning. At the time, I never called it machine learning. But years later, people were like, Charles did machine learning for his PhD, because I guess Bayesian statistical stuff became kind of machine learning. So anyway, I kind of transitioned from doing that kind of interface of that stuff closer and closer towards machine learning, in my first postdoc and my second postdoc, working on using these concepts from statistical physics to try to understand other kinds of machine learning algorithms. So it's just kind of been a journey of, kind of the intersection of biology, machine learning, and sort of like theoretical physics has kind of been where I've been for the last, I don't know, I guess like 15 years.
I see. Interesting. And were you like a self-learner in these tasks of getting the latest knowledge about implementing these tools and techniques in machine learning, or was it always a part of curriculum for biophysics? I'm not sure about the curriculum for biophysics.
There is no curriculum for biophysics. Yeah. I mean that 100% true. So when I did my undergrad in biophysics, so when I went to the University of Michigan, and I started off, I was going to double major in biochemistry and math. And somebody approached me and they said, hey, we're going to create a new major in biophysics in which you can just do those things, but only have one major. You don't need to take the double classes. And I was like, that sounds great. I will switch from this two double major to just one. But it had no real set curriculum at the time. I was the first, there were four of us. We were the first class to graduate from that program as an undergrad. And then for grad school, there were two required classes, research ethics That was a required class. And there was a class, there was like a seminar class where all the faculty came and told you about what the research you were doing. That was it. And then all the other classes were just classes that you decided to take. So I took classes on like mathematical modeling of evolution. I took classes on nonlinear control theory. I took classes on, I don't know, all kinds of stuff. Yeah, dabbled kind of in machine learning things, I guess. Like that's kind of how it went. So there is no curriculum. So in terms of how I learned machine learning the way that I work is that I see a cool machine learning idea and I immediately try to one-up it. That's the way I think. So when I see the idea in the paper, I'm not like, oh, can I re-implement this paper in the way they did? I wanna beat that paper. As soon as I read the paper, I'm like, I could do better than this paper, and I'm implementing it. And I think going back, you know, even to like, you know, again, the kind of like when I was, you know, studying, these were before all of these real programs were available that had all of the nice off the shelf tools you could use. I had to implement a lot of things myself. I still do that today. So, you know, I prefer to really get down today, because I'm a CEO, I'm not supposed to be like writing a lot of code. But like when I do a little code project, I like to understand all of it. You know, I want to be able to get into the nitty gritty. I don't want to just call, you know, Torch's Adam. I want to code Adam. I want to understand how it works. I want to see if I can do better. That's kind of the way that I've always approached those problems. After you've done all that stuff and you know how it works and maybe you've seen you can't do better, then you pull the off-the-shelf tool. But that should be the last step of the thing that you do.
Yeah, no, I really agree that. And I think over the past many years, I think the guests that I've had on this podcast have said one thing that I normally ask, like, how do you get started in machine learning? None of them have really recommended that, oh, hey, you start with this book. I think, like, I mean, there are some great books that help you get started. But I think the best way is to get started on a project, even if it is just re-implementing some stuff, pull the code from GitHub and just rerun the same thing. But I think getting started would be like what you said, like getting started on a project. Like that would, I think, the project itself will teach you more than what you can learn from any kind of definitions or books. So yeah, I mean, I really love that. I think you are one of the crude people who started, like, when machine learning wasn't existing, you started implementing some bunch of techniques which really got mature over time, and now we call it AI or machine learning in general. So that's a very nice way to get started. So yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Of course.
But getting back to, I think, unlearn, like one of the key things that really struck me when I started reading much more about unlearn, and since like even my PhD is at the right intersection of AI and deep learning, like I work with Alzheimer's, post-traumatic headache, phenotypes, so we work with brain imaging. And what really struck me, I think, while I was reading some of the papers that were published as a part of your unlearn, is the idea of digital twins. Like, they really sound very interesting, and at least the word has a very nice, catchy thing to it. Like, it has in what, hey, what is digital twins? Tell me more about it. So I think a very clear understanding, I'll let you talk more about it, but I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it is basically the unlearn itself has the idea of accelerating clinical trials and improving the drug development process using machine learning. So can you talk more about the broad aim of unlearn, and what does this idea of digital twin really mean?
Sure. So the very, very broad aim of what we work on at unlearn is really beyond just clinical trials. Clinical trials is the first thing that we are aiming to apply AI to within medicine to really solve a big problem. And that has to do with AI safety and robustness to errors. And I can talk about that in a few minutes. But in the long term, what we're basically looking at is that medicine today is really driven by trial and error. And when I say try, I mean on people. Like, we just try stuff on people and then we see if it works. We don't really know. I mean, like, that's even if you just go to, like, if you have a condition and you go to the physician, in many cases, they'll just try something on you. And there's even like formulas that are like, first you try this drug, and if that drug doesn't work, then you move on to the next drug. You try that drug, and if that doesn't work, and like, that's not a great way to do things, right? And then when you think about the way we get new experimental therapies to market, which is through clinical trials, that is a big experiment. And we enroll a huge number of people and then we just try stuff on them. That is how we do it, right? And that's medicine is really the only space where we do that. right? In like every other field of science and engineering and technology, before you try something in the real world, you want to have some sort of model system where you can try it first. And that, by model system, I really mean computer model. We ideally want to be able to have computer models. In healthcare, we do this stuff with animal models. We do try stuff in animals before moving to people. But so the real fundamental question of what we want to be able to ask at Unlearn is, can we build these kinds of computer models that allow us to eventually eliminate that entire inhuman trial and error process in medicine? And that's a super big, difficult problem. It probably we won't do that in my lifetime. If we do it in my lifetime, then I'll get to live a lot longer, right? Yeah. But it's a very, very challenging problem. So in the kind of way that we focus on it is that we want to be able to build what we call digital twins of individual people. And what that basically is going to be is I want to have a computer model of an individual person that allows me to simulate and forecast what's going to happen to that person's health in the future under all different kinds of scenarios, right? And potentially at different timescales. So within the course of a clinical trial, we're usually asking about timescales that are on the order of months. So what will happen to this person over the next few months? But there's a lot of other applications where you might be asking more longer term questions. What's going to happen to this person over the next few years if they, you know, make these lifestyle changes or if they take these different medications? How are those things going to affect their health in the future? Those are all the kinds of questions that we want to be able to ask. Now, the concept of a digital twin is used in engineering all the time. People build digital twins of things and they apply them. They collect data from a real individual device. They feed that into the computer model. They simulate stuff. The challenging part about thinking about this in medicine is that all of those things we're simulating in engineering, we have blueprints for because we built them, right? And so we know what all the pieces are and exactly how they interact with each other. But the human body has 37 trillion cells in it. That's 100 times the number of stars there are in the galaxy. So thinking about that, we're going to build a mechanistic model that says, like, here's this piece and here's this piece, like a reductionist model of the human body, is ridiculous. Like, there is no chance that we're going to do that. So rather than thinking about sort of treating it in that bottom-up way, sort of using AI lets us take a top-down approach, where basically what we're saying is we're not going to model all the individual pieces. We're going to build phenomenological models that are based on data. So we're going to look at all of these sort of longitudinal data of patients where we can see how patients evolve and over time under different scenarios. And we're going to learn from those data how to simulate the evolution of future patients. So it turns it kind of into a natural, like typical AI problem to create these digital twins.
I see. Yeah, this is very interesting. And I think I love the idea that you started off with saying like the safety. Like, funny enough, I have the very next question over here that relates to safety. But I had one more question. So I think I read one of the papers that was related to Alzheimer's research that you had, I think, in 2018 or 19. I'm sorry if I'm wrong with the dates.
It's around that,
yeah. But well, like, since I work with similar sets of problems, I had one question is, does these digital twins or the whole model that you are trying to build factor in for heterogeneity? Because few of the medical problems that have really heterogeneous structure, like I could be suffering from Alzheimer's, but I could have a completely set of different symptoms or different morphological features. I'm not sure if the model itself works with imaging data. Like, do you ever stumble onto these problems when you are working with digital twins, or is it handled by some mechanism inside the model?
So the models that we use, that we always use, there's a huge, I said, we use a huge family of different models. There's all different kinds of things that we're doing. And some of them use imaging data, some of them don't. A lot of that has to do with really the application areas, because if whatever inputs you're going to use to your model, those had been remeasured in your application area. Otherwise, what are you doing, right? So a lot of it is like we're working backwards from what's going to be measured in these different disease areas and then you leveraging those data. But one of the key things that we think about is that we do probabilistic modeling. And so when we're talking about, we're actually modeling heterogeneity. So when we're looking out in the future and saying, well, what's going to happen to this person in the future? That's a stochastic trajectory of possible outcomes. And then we can actually ask, well, what do we think is the range of possible outcomes at 12 months or 18 months or whatever it is timescale we're looking at? And we actually see that there are areas where we have large uncertainties in what's going to happen to a patient and areas in which we have low uncertainties in what's going to happen to a patient. And they can definitely be very different. You know, you're having nonlinear, you know, these are nonlinear, complicated, dynamical systems where, you know, some patients progress really rapidly, other progress, say, get better. And, you know, there's all of these different factors that factor into it. You know, the one area there that I would say is like when we think about these aspects of sort of heterogeneity of outcomes and heterogeneity of populations, I think you get into some questions of explainability as to whether or not, and personally, I'm actually not a fan of explainability in AI. I think that uncertainty quantification is really important. I have some blog I wrote many, many years ago saying that uncertainty is way more important than explainability. I think people focus on explainability too much. And I think not enough focus is done on uncertainty quantification, which I actually think is a more important problem. I would really want to know, like, if I'm making a prediction, how confident should I be in that? I think it's much more important question than why am I making this prediction?
Right. And I assume, like, so when these digital twins are being used by a certain set of real world physicians or doctors or clinicians, does it give kind of error quantification saying that, hey, I'm not sure really what the prediction is, but this is my loose understanding? Or does it give a very strong prediction? Because there could be cases where the model is not really sure, right? Like, I think a physician would really want that kind of honesty from the model that, hey, I'm not really sure because this looks like kind of a heterogeneous data to me that I've not seen. Or like, or is there some other sophisticated way that you try to quantify these errors from the model?
Oh no, yeah, exactly. I mean, for everything that we predict, you want to predict the range of, you want to predict the distribution over time of all of these things. Yeah. Everything should be determined in terms of some uncertainty. Now, whether or not today physicians are interacting directly with the outputs of our models, they're not actually. But so like that never happens today. That's a physician looks at the outcome and it's like, I need to use this to make a decision. That's a thing that we want to work on in the future. But it's just not something that's not done in the clinical trial applications that we're currently focused on.
Right. And I think, like, correct me if I'm wrong. So digital twins would be something that facilitates or improves the clinical trial process. And how does this relate to drug development? Because, like, again, pardon with the naivety, but I think I don't know how drug development really works. Is it part of the whole digital twins outcomes, or like how does the product at Unlearn really help drug development?
Perfect sense. So first of all, I'm going to separate two phases of drug development process. There was the drug design process, and there's actually a lot of work going on in machine learning right now on like graph neural networks and generative things that create chemicals. That's a whole thing of like generative models of chemical structures and stuff. That's all what I would call drug design. And so that all happens, and then you do all of this chemistry stuff. You find your drug, you're testing it in usually model systems like cells, eventually into model systems like animals. And if all of that looks promising, then you move on to testing it in people. And testing it in people is what I would call drug development. And that is sort of that's the piece that we focus on. Most compounds, most things don't ever make it even into being tested in people, because there's all kinds of things. You don't want to experiment on people unless you're really pretty confident that you're going to be able to move the needle. But even still, 1 in 10 drugs that enters in human trials actually ends up being successful. So 90% fail. And you go through typically 3 stages of clinical trials. So I'm going to grossly generalize here, but for a phase 1 clinical trial, so this is your first kind of step after your animal models. Typically, you will take your drug and you will give it to like around 10 healthy volunteers. So these are not people who have the disease. Yeah. And you take it and you increase the dose until you observe some sort of signals of side effects or things, and then that helps you figure out how safe it is and what the relevant dose is. So then you take that information, and then you're going to run what's called a phase 2 clinical trial. So in a phase 2 clinical trial, you're going to take about usually 100 people or so who actually have this disease. You're going to randomly assign half of them to receive your new experimental therapy, and the other half you're going to assign a placebo. And then you're going to run that study, And at the end of the study, you're going to observe the difference between the experimental and control groups, and that's going to tell you if your drug looks like it might be effective. And the phase two is really for the pharma company, the developer, to decide if they want to make the investment to run a big phase three trial. So your phase three trials, you're enrolling often thousands of patients. And here, you're really looking for a strong confirmatory signal that your drug is effective and to some degree safe. You can look for some signals of adverse events in clinical trials, but in many cases, events that are like adverse events are relatively rare. So you can have rare serious events, and the sample sizes in clinical trials are actually too small to see that. So you look at those typically later, actually, once the drug is on the market. That's why sometimes you'll see drugs pulled from the market because of some rare side effect. So that's basically the process. So these phase three and these phase two clinical trials, these late stage part of drug development, you're enrolling thousands of patients. Half of them are receiving some new experimental treatment, which in theory, you actually have no data about. It's brand new. But the other half of the patients are receiving a placebo, usually in combination with whatever the current standard of care is. And that is something that you have a ton of data about. These are just patients who are receiving the treatment that everybody with that disease receives. Yeah. So what we're basically doing is our goal is to apply sort of these, is to use digital twins in such a way that we can reduce the number of patients in clinical trials who have to be given placebos. We cannot eliminate entirely. So we can't say zero patients receive a placebo. If you do that, you run into these AI safety problems that I'm talking about. But if we say, well, you still have some patients receiving placebos and some patients receiving your experimental therapy and they're randomly assigned, then we can actually leverage the simulations that we have of all of these patients in a way that we can actually ensure these clinical trials have the same statistical properties as clinical trials without the simulations. So you end up being able to run a trial that's smaller, that has fewer patients receiving placebos, but still generates just as rigorous results, which is really valuable for all the patient volunteers because they have a much higher chance of getting the experimental therapy, which is usually the reason that people choose to participate in trials in the first place. But these trials are also incredibly expensive. Talking about individual clinical trials costing $100 million or more for a pharma company and taking like 5 years. So if we can reduce the number of patients that you need to get the evidence that you need, that saves tremendous amount of time and cost in the drug development process.
Yeah. And sounds from it, I think this is kind of a win-win situation for both the parties, right? I think a person who is like the pharma companies or basically the institutes that are doing these trials and also the patients, I think that really helps both of them. But I'm curious about one thing is like, how does the sentiment of using these kind of machine learning based simulations hold in people's mind, like who are designing these clinical trials or people who are like from a medical background? Do they still adopt these simulation results, or do they still stick to their own well-known standard, let's say whatever defined they have, that is not relevant to these statistical studies? Like, is it like a hard time convincing them the potential of these techniques, or are they very skeptical?
So we are working with pharma companies now. We actually got a regulatory qualification from the European Medicines Agency, so the FDA of the EU, that came out about a month ago. So we have quite a few proof points that this approach provides, like you said, it's a win-win scenario, and that it produces rigorous results that really look just like any old RCT. So you get the same kind of results that you would get, just smaller and faster.
Yeah.
That said, people in medicine are skeptical of anything that uses a computer. A computer is a scary thing that is this weird black box. They don't understand how it works, and they don't usually like computer. So being able to sort of figure out how, I'd say two parts of that. One part is like, how do we generate the kind of validation data, but not just the validation data. Like we can prove, we have actual papers that have theorems that prove that the clinical trials that we run are produce rigorous results. We actually mathematically prove certain aspects of that about that. So I think going through as many steps as we can to establish trust in the community is important. But establishing trust takes a long time. And so, you know, we're a startup. we can't wait around for forever to establish. If it takes us 15 years to establish trust in the community, that's too long. That's not a startup time scale. So the other thing that we have to do is really focus, I would say, on our business development efforts on identifying people who really want to apply innovative techniques. And those people absolutely exist, right? So what you're saying is we're focusing on, say, the 25% of people who are most innovative, and we're going to spend our time trying to partner with those people. And once we have established ourselves in working with these kind of innovative partners, then we will have, we can have all of the rest of the community follow. That's really, you know, it's again, it's like this mixture of kind of like the approaches we use technically are sound, but it's like you still are seen as innovative and new. And that certainly is a challenge for every single company working in the entire healthcare space.
I see. And I think you did mention about trust and interpretability. So I was curious, like, I think there are these two paradigms that normally people use, like, how do we make these black box models really adopted in the real world, like the democratization of AI? And you mentioned two things, like one is basically the idea of the path of where people start developing interpretable models or explainable models versus having a framework where you have a really strong validation framework saying, like, we have some rigorous processes in place, like the standard, like the legacy engineering processes that we have, software engineering, we have these very strong validation tools that go into it. So I'm like, you did mention about, like, you are not a big fan of interpretable efforts. So I'm curious, like, why, like, I want to first start, like, why?
Why don't I like interpretability?
Yeah.
I don't believe it. I think that it's fake. I think that the interpretations that people put on things are storytelling. I don't think they're real. And I think that in order to get a model that really looks like it's interpretable, you're basically just eliminating all of the nonlinearities in your problem. And if you eliminate all the nonlinearities of the problem, then, like, what are you doing? So nonlinear systems are not predictable. Like, that's how they work. That's why every single thing that studies a nonlinear differential equation in the literature says the step one is we linearized our differential equation, right? Like, that's always step one of every theoretical analysis of a nonlinear differential equation. So I just don't think they're real. I don't believe in explainability methods. I don't think they're real. It's a little bit like, you know, if you ask me how I came to, like, why I did something or, like, how my brain works, I tell you a story after the fact. I rationalize it after the fact. That's not really the reason. And so that's the same thing here. I just don't think that when we're talking about deep neural networks, I just don't think explainability is real. I think it's a story we're telling ourselves to make ourselves feel good. I don't believe it.
So I think there are two points. Like, is it something, like, for sure, like, I think techniques like GradCam, saliency maps, they are not definitely effective. I think a lot of people have shown how they are robust to noise or maybe adversarial attacks. So is it these methods not performing well, and that's your concern? Or is it, let's say hypothetically I come up with a solution that, or maybe some kind of technique that is totally robust and is trying to maybe explain in the best way these nonlinear associations. Mm-hmm. Would you still be interested in the idea of interpretability, or is it something, these techniques that are published out there are something that you don't really have confidence with?
What I would say is, so that I'm skeptical that one could come up with techniques for interpretability that will work. If somebody demonstrates, in some way, and comes up with some theorems and proves their stuff works, and not machine learning theorems, like every machine learning paper has these irrelevant theorems in it. I mean, like a theorem that's actually relevant to the real world under real world scenarios, like people actually demonstrate something for real, then that's maybe a different scenario. But I wait to be impressed. That's what I would say. I'm waiting to be impressed by something in that field. The thing that I would say is, for us, clinical trials are extremely unique. They are extremely unique when it comes to this kind of AI safety question, right? And so it's a couple of things. So first of all, we are making predictions of what happens to patients, assuming every patient are what we're doing in a clinical trial, saying what would happen to this patient if they received the control. What would happen if they received the control? And we make that prediction for all of these people in the clinical trial. So 1,000 patients enroll in your clinical trial, we create 1,000 simulations of what would happen to each one of those people if they got the control. And then we are working in randomized controlled trials. Some of the patients are receiving the experimental treatment, and we're predicting what would have happened if they got the control. So that difference between those two things is an estimate of how effective the treatment is. but some of the patients are receiving the control. And we are predicting what would have happened if they got the control. And the difference is an in population estimate of any errors that you have in your model. And so what this allows us to do is, because we're doing random, and it's randomized, right? The assignment is randomized. So you're breaking any sort of confounding, at least an expectation, confounding relationships, right? And so, so now you can actually use this randomization as a tool to formally correct for errors in your model in the actual population you're studying. It's very, very interesting and very, very different from, like, say, as soon as we were to say, like, hey, doctor, you're going to take this patient's digital twin and you're going to use it to make a decision about what to do with this one individual person. That's a totally different story. All of a sudden, the user is immediately exposed to the model, and the model had better be right. But that's, the clinical trials is actually a very, very different situation, where we can take models that are that may or may not be perfect. That are not perfect. They're AI models. No AI model is perfect, right? So we can take these models that have imperfections and that make mistakes, and we can do it in a way, wrap this up within this randomization in a way that the user, the consumer of the outcome of the clinical trials, is protected from it. It's a really interesting thing. The randomization protects the user from the errors that the model makes. So it's a very, very interesting way of thinking about sort of AI safety, where it's really focused on a particular use case of a model. So it's not like that these models would be safe for all uses. They're safe for this one particular use, which I think is a better way to think about AI safety in general, actually.
Yeah. I think this is a little bit better than how we are normally using deep learning for diagnosis or prognosis, where we normally label the patient as in, like, this person is under some kind of disease or any kind of diagnosis disease, versus he's or she healthy, because that puts a much more greater risk of high stake, as in, like, do these deep learning model predictions really make sense?
It could be. I think that my claim is it depends on how those predictions are used.
Yeah,
depends on how those predictions are used, and I think that if you can't separate the question of safety away from the question of use, if I make a prediction for this prognosis of a thing, and I decide whether or not I should give this person a glass of carbonated water or still water at dinner, probably safety doesn't really matter. Right? Yeah. Probably safe, right? So that particular use case would be fine. Whereas, like, if I'm saying, like, oh, I'm trying to decide whether or not I should give this person an insulin injection or not, that particular use case probably not safe, right? So it's really, really important that when we think about safety around models, it's not safety around models, it's safety around uses of models. And so that use case is really, really important. And so, you know, if you think about the kind of prognostic or diagnostic research that's happening, the current framework for, like, those things within healthcare has been like, there's a doctor in the loop. So it doesn't say the doctor is there. It's sort of like the self-driving cars. They have the person sitting there behind the wheel, right? Like, ready to take the wheel if the car like veers off the road. It's this kind of similar idea that you have this person there. But of course that person is also a human and they can make mistakes, right, too. So it's still that use case is way more difficult. The use case within clinical trials, again, is a special case where we can leverage randomization to basically provide safety. And it's a very, very interesting use case. I'm curious if there are other areas where we could think about doing that in other contexts. Currently, that's the reason why we focus on clinical trials as our number one first use case, is because we know that this is an area where we can have an impact and where we could do so rigorously and safely. And safely, as opposed to, like, there have been some scandals recently around some algorithms in healthcare that were being used to triage patients, right? So, like, sepsis prediction algorithms that actually caused harm. Like, those algorithms, their use caused harm. In our case, you know, the use of the algorithms in this context, we can ensure does not cause harm.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, I think what you said makes sense, as in, like, where exactly this model is placed in the whole workflow really matters. And I think in your case, you have at least a cushion factor of a person in the loop that really helps so that it's not really exposed.
We have randomization in the loop. Yeah. It's better than human in the loop. We have a randomization in the loop. And so it's actually, like, even the way that it works basically is the way we do these clinical trial designs. You have some number of patients who are receiving your experimental treatment and some number of patients receiving your control. Yeah. we're actually determining those numbers in such a way that it's sort of like we're shrinking the control group down to the point where you would lose the safety property. So it's sort of like you shrink the control group down, but then there's a maximum amount right now that you can shrink it before you would start to take on some additional risk. And so as our models get better and better over time and we get more and more validation, you can shrink that more and more. But that's kind of the way that it works. It's like we're saying, okay, we need to guarantee safety. So first that's step number one, and then we shrink relative to that, like while staying within that constraint.
Yeah. And one last question that pops up when I think about safety is, we as programmers or people who develop these or work with these algorithms have a total different understanding of what safety looks like versus like, what's your experience when you're dealing with, like you said, yeah, you recently got the regulatory approval. So like people who don't have an understanding of machine learning versus people who are physicians or clinicians who are using these trials, are they really satisfied with the validation framework that we normally talk about, like rigorous framework and all those things? Are they satisfied? Like, does that really step up a milestone when we use these machine learning models in real world? Like, what has your experience been like dealing with those people?
Yeah. My experience is that if you're trying to go in and convince somebody that your model is very, very good and accurate and its use will be good, you're going to have a bad time. My experience is that that's going to be very difficult. Trying to convince somebody to believe your model is going to be hard, right? Mm-hmm. Again, like within the clinical trial space, like a regulatory qualification is not around a particular model. It's not saying, hey, this model is good. Thumbs up on the model. It's actually saying, here's a framework for using outcomes of models. If you follow this use case framework, everything is cool, regardless of what model you plug into it. So it actually abstracts away from the model. That's why I talk about AI safety is not about models, it's about use cases. You should think about use cases and prove safety for a particular use case, regardless of what model you put. To some degree, true AI safety means that even if I take a crap model that has a bug in the code and outputs nonsense, the user is unaffected. That's safety, right? And so that comes down to how you use a model, not how you make the model. If you're saying, in order for this model to be acceptable, I need to know the model achieves a certain bar of performance, then you don't really have exactly safety. Like, you're relying on belief in the model being good. And we want to say you don't have to rely on belief on the model being good. The model could be totally wrong and you're still safe. And that's a very, very different thing that focuses on how the models are used, not how they're created or validated.
Yeah. This is really interesting thought. I think, yeah, because the reason I am really intrigued about this is when I started my PhD, like one of the key ideas that really struck me as like very interesting thesis topic was something around working with interpretability, right? Like as in, how do I develop a model that can really explain these, like what you said, like nonlinear associations? And at some point, I think I left off that particular thought of process. I started working on much more other problem sets, but these ideas really intrigued me. And I think this really makes more sense, having these use cases, like focusing on what does the model say when it says something and what do we need to do or act on those predictions, have a much more better place in real world use cases rather than having like grad chem based heat maps on image banks. So yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
And again, it's just like, you know, a model might make an error on something and that may be totally irrelevant to the user. Right. So, yeah. Or model may, its explanation may be wrong and that may be totally irrelevant to the user, or its explanation may be right and the user could still be harmed. Right. So the real question is not to ask about what models are doing, but instead about whether or not the user is harmed or not. And that you can't do that by just looking at your model. You can't. It has to be focused on really the user experience.
Interesting. And I want to switch gears. I mean, this is a very interesting topic, but I want to switch gears to the part where you, as a person who started off this idea as Unlearn, and I think, like, correct me if I'm wrong, like you were on track to being in academia. I'm not sure what your end goal was before starting Unlearn. So I want to learn, like, you did your postdoc, PhD, and I think like that would be a very standard blueprint for a person who wanted to be in the academia as a researcher or as a professor. So I want to learn. So I have two set of questions. So the first one is, as a researcher, if we are in the field for a long time, there are lots of ideas being thrown around in grant meetings and papers and conferences. And every day, like it feels like, okay, I have an idea, I can make a particular product and change the whole world. Versus a lot of those ideas just end up being a paper on archive or at some journal. And that's it. Like it just ends over there. So I have like the first question is, what was that X factor that you realized that, hey, I just don't want to just publish one paper and prove some results or some tables or metrics, but I want to take it to the next level and create a much more broader impact? And secondly, what made you shift out of academia after such a long time? Like you invested a long time. So what was your point that you decided, hey, I'm going to give up my stable job and do a few more years of messy work?
Yeah. So it's actually even worse than I think you said in your introduction. I did not just do one postdoc at Boston University. I did two postdocs. I did a second postdoc at a university in Paris. So yeah. I was truly on the academic track. I had every intention of being a professor. I think that, so I didn't immediately go from academia to starting the startup. I moved from academia to industry, right? So in that sense, it was really curiosity, I would say, that drove me to leave academia to go to industry. Because when I was in academia, first of all, it's even just the term industry, I find hilarious. Because what does that mean? Industries, companies are really different from each other. Am I in industry if I like you know, I'm a train conductor? Am I in industry if I'm doing medical research? Like, what does industry mean? It's very, very broad. And I just had no idea what it is that people did at companies. I really didn't know. I was like, I don't know what people do at companies. What's life like there? Is it better than this? Like I had kind of grown up in academia. It actually really in a lot of ways. My you know, father's a professor, a university professor. I really grew up in academia. So for me, it was just like, okay, well, this is interesting. I'll go see what maybe it'll be interesting. So I had a colleague of mine from grad school, another person who was in the same lab as me, who had gone to MIT. He was at MIT and then he had gone to Pfizer. He'd gone to Pfizer, which is down the street from MIT, and was working on kind of like in a small machine learning group there. This was like 2015. And, you know, the pharma companies at that point, and kind of still to a degree, just dipping their toe in machine learning, seeing like, is, you know, does this seem interesting? And so he kind of recruited me to leave my second postdoc where I was in Paris and to move back to Boston to go work in that machine learning group. And then I was kind of interested in like, but all my whole career had been at that intersection, like I said, of biology and machine learning and in physics. And I was like, well, what do people do in other areas that are more computer science-y, maybe less biology? So I moved out to San Francisco and worked at this virtual reality company. And that was, again, it was kind of curiosity, like, what's it going to be like at there? And in terms of like taking that leap from those kinds of curiosity-driven things to starting Unlearn. Unlearn for me was not a curiosity driven thing. I have co-founders and I think for them, it was a little more curiosity driven than for me. Unlearn is a 100% a frustration driven company. And everyone who I hear that's thinking about whether or not they want to start a company or not, I ask, well, how angry and frustrated are you? Because you should start a company because you're really angry and frustrated with something in society. That's the number one, if that's the number one reason you should start a company. There's something about society that really frustrates you and that you want to fix it. And to me, that's just what I have had my whole career, again, working at that intersection of biology and life sciences research with, you know, computer science, has been that, man, the field life sciences just feels 15, 20 years behind. And I just look at it and I'm like, yeah, there's so much that by leveraging these new techniques, you could save people's lives. You really could. And you could improve the quality of life for people all over the world. And the field moves so slowly and is so skeptical that it's costing people's lives. And I am angry about that. And so Unlearn is a frustration of my, is a expression of my frustration and anger at the lack of adoption of technology within life sciences, 100%. And so the way that it is, like, I sort of view myself in a fight, like in a war, to get new technologies adopted. And I really think that this is the right way. If anyone wants to be an entrepreneur, they need to have that attitude. Because entrepreneurship is really hard. It is super duper hard. You encounter skepticism, naysayers. It takes a long time. We started this company 5 years ago, you know, and it takes a long time. And you have to make a lot of difficult decisions along the way. And if you're just doing it for fun, you're gonna stop, right? But if you're doing it out of frustration, every obstacle you encounter just adds to your frustration and makes you more motivated, right? So I think frustration is the number one reason people should start companies. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it makes sense. I mean, it's a funny way to put it, but I think a lot of people who are entrepreneurs, I think they are trying to solve something, like they find a problem. And I think it makes sense, like in a way, you can say, yes, they are frustrated about something and they just want that to be fixed. So yeah, I think, I forgot the name, like the guy who invented telephone, right? Like the reason he invented telephone was just because he wanted to talk to someone, I think maybe his wife or something. That I think that's the story. I don't know if that's the reality, but I think that's what they say in textbooks. So yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like you have to be really frustrated about it and really focused about it. So, and what other question is, because you were on your track to academia, do you see a major stark differences between how research projects look like in academia, as in like when you were a student versus when you were a postdoctoral researcher, or what you would have thought you being a professor, how you would lead a project versus at Pfizer, which is like a very big company, like lots of collaborations, versus now you are at Unlearn. Like you have a small team, you are leading it, and you're the person who is envisioning stuff. So can you, like, do you see any differences between working on these projects in these three scenarios?
Yeah, definitely. Honestly, not very big differences between working in academia and working at Pfizer. Kind of similar. I wouldn't have said they were super different. I mean, obviously I have more directed, like the way I would have described it is like in academia, you can kind of work on anything. Like you have this screen field of stuff that you can work on. And then, you know, you kind of narrow the scope a little bit and then you say, okay, well, this is Pfizer now. Like you could, but it's still pretty broad actually. Like, you know, as long as, you know, what you were doing seemed kind of reasonable, like you could work on it. Maybe you couldn't spend your whole time on it. But you could definitely, you definitely had some freedom to work on different types of projects. Startup is totally different. That's not to say you don't have freedom. You do, but you need to fail really quickly. And I think that's the number one difference between what we do at a startup and like what you do in academia. In academia, people are like, there's this constant like, yeah, maybe if I just tweak it, I can maybe figure out all the details or whatever, and I can get a paper out of it or whatever. Like, nah, that's not the way it works in at a startup. You want to basically, you go down a pathway, 2 weeks, you make a go, no go decision, right? So every 2 weeks, you should be looking at something and saying, is this, do I still want to be doing it? Is this right? Or is this a failure? And just if, or it's not even, something might work if you were to invest a huge amount of 2 years in it. But if it takes you 2 years to invest into that problem to get it to work, then it's not for you. It's not for a startup, right? You need to go get to work now. Yeah. So it's just a very different sense of urgency and pace at startups than it is in academia or at these big, you know, Pfizer's an enormous company. Right. And I think that's like they have more of an academic pace typically. It's much more closer. But a startup is just like fast, go, 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 go all the time. And so but like the research freedom, I think at the same sense is pretty like we do these things. We just did one this week at the company where we do these hackathons. Right. Hackathon doesn't mean anyone works on anything. It's actually, so we have a kind of unique way to do it. A team, first of all, a team is going to work together. So it's not an individual project. The team is going to work together on a thing. And we have different, so a team might be like five people. And each person is going to write down their idea that they want to pursue on a piece of paper. We're going to put it in a hat. We're going to choose one out. And then you have a week to do it, make it work. Like, and so that it's like, so we're trying, like you definitely try innovative ideas. You want to find the next big thing that's going to move the needle, but you also just can't, you just can't take forever to figure out whether it moves the needle or not. You need to have that decision quickly.
Yeah. It sounds very interesting. And yeah, I think that those are one of the few, like the stakes really become high. I think in research, we are just trying to improve a metric versus in startup, you're trying to make a difference that is already at scale. And I think at scale is something researchers and academia typically don't realize. I mean, not their fault, like it's something that offer a different focus, so nothing to criticize both of them. But yeah, in startup, it becomes very, very delicate, as in like when you're trying to propose something, you better make it 1,000% sure, only then you can make it. Yeah. Versus in academia, you have much more freedom.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I would say is, this is exactly what academia is, everyone knows, that academia is a beauty contest, right? In the end, academia is a beauty contest in that it's really about opinion. You publish a paper, it isn't about whether your paper is actually good or not. It is people's opinion of the paper. It is very, very subjective, right? And so you have kind of this constant arguing of ideas. So publishing your paper isn't the end of your paper. You don't publish it, and then it goes up there on the archive, and it's done. Now you got to go talk to people about it. You got to go to conferences. You got to give seminars. You have to convince people that it is a good idea to adopt. Right. And other people are out there with their competing ideas, convincing you that trying to convince them that theirs is a good thing to adopt. It's a beauty contest. Right. In the end, it's all about what do people like more. Right. Yeah. That's down to the level of individual ideas. Right. Like, what machine learning model should we be using? Oh, well, that's going to turn into the same thing. It turns into this beauty contest. Industry is quite a bit different from that. Like, it's certainly within a company. Just having people argue about which idea they like, they think is better, or which one makes more sense, or which one is more logical. That's a huge waste of time. Arguing about the principles behind this, in theory, it's a huge waste of time. Just try it. Like, so that is, it is a very different attitude, which is like, try these things together and see which one works and make the call right away based upon which one actually worked, you know? So it's almost like, you can take like A/B testing principles and just apply them to everything that you do all the time. So it's like, imagine that you did that in an academic lab, right? It's like you have, it's also academia is very individual, right? So you have your idea and this, your lab, mate has their idea and you're working on separate theses. That's not the way. So a company is just like, 50 people all working towards the same goal, try to solve the same problem. And it doesn't matter who solves it, right? It just matters that it gets solved. And so you say, okay, we got 50 people, 10 teams, 10 ideas, go. And whichever one of them works, you just A/B testing all the way along. It's a very, very different approach because it's collaborative. Even across companies, there's more collaboration than there is competition. If you think about the number of companies there are in the world, right? Ideally, if you've done a good job of choosing your market, you have many more customers than you have competitors. If you're in a reverse market, we have more competitors than customers, you made a mistake, right? Right? So, and your relationship with a customer is a collaboration. Yeah. You both want your product to be successful. The customer is buying your product. They want it to work and you want it to work. So that's a collaboration. And so you actually, industry is much more collaborative than academia. Academia is a very antagonistic area in general, whereas industry tends to be within a company, much more collaborative environment. You're working together. But even across companies, for the most part, that's actually collaborative too.
Yeah. Yeah, but would it be fair to say that you would have like least interest in going back to academia at certain point in life? Or
I want to go back to academia?
Maybe later, yeah, something. Would that be totally out of the window?
I certainly like doing research. I very much enjoy doing research. Even as a CEO, I'm not supposed to do research. I hope none of our board of directors watches this podcast. it's like I for my sanity, sort of need like a small quarterly like research project where I might spend, a couple of hours a week kind of thinking about something. I need that. Otherwise I would go insane. I try my best to choose things that are kind of like off out of the way of, so I don't hold up other people, cause I'm working slower than everybody else. So could I imagine myself going back to academia? Yes. Yeah, I certainly could. I like doing research. I like teaching okay, but I actually consider myself to be a pretty bad teacher. I don't know if I would be good at it.
Interesting. You mentioned something about like you don't dabble around with research a lot recently as becoming a founder and CEO. So what does your routine look like? I think I'm not sure if I have asked this question. I don't know if I have had a CEO on the CEO on a podcast. So what does your routine look like now that you said you don't work with research.
So as a CEO basically has three different jobs. The first one is the chief evangelism officer. So that what that basically means is that you're going to go around, you're going to talk about how great your company is. And ideally you're talking about, might be talking to how great it is to work there or what kind of impact you're going to have on the world or how much money it's going to make. It depends on kind of what audience you're talking to, but you're just talking about how great your company is. For myself, mostly I want to talk about the impact that we're going to have on the world. That's what I like to talk about. You just kind of go everywhere and talk about that to whoever will listen to you. So that's one job. A second job is cash extraction officer. So cash extraction officer is like companies need money to operate. And this is different ways because, you know, we're a venture-backed company. We've raised in total now about $85 million in venture capital. And so that's going out, talking to investors, and again, telling the story, both about the social impact that you're going to have. I think that for a lot of investors, social impact matters. But also, you're talking about, you know, if this company works, because a startup always has risks. You actually don't know if your company is going to work or not. So you say, if this company works, what does that future look like in terms of a financial outcome? So if this works, could this be a big company? And that's usually, those are the kind of the two questions that, that investors are usually asked. So that's the second thing. And then there's the normal chief executive officer piece of it. And basically a chief executive officer is about building a team of people. And again, a team is, I mean, like five people, you know, 5 to 7 people. So you've got 5 to 7 people who you trust. And your job is to just provide direction and clarity to people within the company. That's basically it. So you do two, that's your, you have three jobs: clarity with the people who work in your company, talk to investors, or potentially, you know, talking to customers, because, you know, another way is cash extraction could be saying, you know, that you're selling, that you're actually acting as basically a salesperson. And then your third thing is just evangelism. And that's that. So my day, is sort of split between those kinds of three activities. And which one is dominant just depends. So there's certain times where I spend all of my time focusing on organizational clarity. And I'm just talking to people at the company about, here's what we're doing right now. Everything else that's not this thing we're doing, stop doing that. We're only focused on this one thing right now. That's clarity, right? Then there's times where, no, we're raising capital and I'm 100% talking to investors. And then there's other times where I'm really just doing this evangelism, where I'm going to conferences, I'm giving seminars, I'm doing, you know, giving interviews. Like, so it's a split between all of those different things. The research part, again, I'm not supposed to do it at all. I just do it because I like to.
Yeah, interesting. So it's basically the idea is to get this word out that you guys, what the work you guys are doing is something more of a priority as being a CEO compared to what we are like. And if you're a researcher, you're the person who is making your hands dirty working on these projects. Versus yeah. Now it's like you have this thing. Let me try to reach out to people and maybe work on creating much more of a finesse in this product. So that would be
one of the things that at least I would say is a little bit unique for myself, because not that unique, because I'm a technical CEO, but being a technical CEO isn't actually that unique at a startup. At a big company, it's pretty unique to actually have a scientist or engineer as a CEO, but not at a startup. That's pretty 50-50 maybe. I would say that another thing that I try to do is give permission. I don't know, it should not something that you should have to do, but sometimes people are hesitant to try crazy ideas, right? Yeah. So you'll have some researcher and they're like, I got some crazy idea. I don't know if I can try it. And I come in and I say, go try that, please. so that is that, I would say that's kind of like the most fun part of the job to me, is that I can come in and, like, you know, encouraging people to really be innovative and try new things is something that I really want to try to do. And yeah, that's probably the part of it that I most enjoy.
And you also did mention about team building. So, like, looking back, like, this would be a question like a lot of listeners of this particular podcast would be interested is, do you think working as a researcher, either at least for the industry, does getting a PhD really help you? Like, if I want to become a machine learning engineer, AI researcher, or something who is working on a research forefront of a project, do you think doing a PhD has some kind of advantage? Or is it something, if you're not going into the academia, it's totally useless? So if you were to look back on your PhD, does that really help you or give you an advantage over other candidates?
I think it helped me, but I think it depends on the person. It depends on what you do your PhD in, obviously. Like all these things depend a lot. Depends on who your advisor is. Yeah. I don't know if the things that you would learn in a traditional PhD, if you think about, like, was my coursework useful? No. He's useless. I mean, it's interesting, but I took courses in all kinds of just random stuff. It wasn't even had a theme in it. So coursework, useless. The actual technical skills that I developed, obviously super useful. I was working on implementing algorithms from scratch. I had to understand how they worked. That was super duper useful. Still use it to today. Could I have gained that skill doing something else? Probably. but I gained it in a PhD. To me, the biggest thing that I had is I did undergraduate research, right? And then I had a PhD, and then I did my postdoc, and then there's a second postdoc. But all of my advisors all really strongly emphasized presenting. And I think that this is the number one thing that actually a PhD is useful for. There is really no other job that I can think of other than, frankly, being like a CEO, where you have the opportunity to give that many presentations. And everyone, like every single scientific conference, you are going to give a poster, you are going to give a oral presentation. You should be doing that constantly, but not just like regular group meetings. Like, you should be giving presentations constantly. All of your papers, you're writing all the time. That's a presentation. And so I had advisors that emphasized presentation skills over, like, we were giving group meeting weekly and getting torn to shreds about how we were presenting things. And there is no other thing that I can think of other than a PhD that provides you that opportunity for years, over and over, weekly to work on your presentation skills. And if you're going into industry, your presentation skills are the most important thing that you have. That's it. Like, ultimately, it's your ability to talk about what you're doing that's going to move you forward in industry. So I actually think that a PhD is great, can be great preparation for industry and for entrepreneurship if you have an advisor that's really, if you're taking the opportunity to use your PhD to hone your presentation skills. Yeah, I can hear my dog squeaking a dog toy in the background. I'm not sure if the mic's picking that up.
it's not that horrible, so that's good. I think he's trying to get you out because it's like a Friday 5 p.m. so he's asking where are you. So but yeah, I'll just let you in a few minutes. And the one other, like, I think maybe the last question I have is, I read it, I think it was one of the Unlearned blogs or something, where you said like you're working on innovative ML models. And one other question that I always I personally ask myself is, do these kind of working on interdisciplinary research, like you are working on problems that have a particular application in mind rather than working on synthetic data sets like ImageNet or something. Mm-hmm. So do these kind of problems when you are working really inspire you for innovation in architectural or maybe let's say methodological research in deep learning? Like, have you had any moments where you said, oh, you know, like using this as an inspiration, I can actually tweak the model, but not just like hyperparameter tuning or something like that, but that can lead me towards architectural innovation?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that architectures are driven by problems and typically driven by the kinds of data you have. For us working in the healthcare space, the number one thing that we deal with is that we have a huge amount of missing data. And I don't just mean missing features. Like, we're doing time series modeling. So you have, first of all, we're doing time series modeling, which is already interesting. And then you have a huge amount of missing features over time. And as features change. And so then you start to say, okay, well, wait a second. I'm not just doing imagine you're working on images, right? But where you have, not only are you doing image in painting, where you might have missing information at test time. What if all of your data was missing at train time? What if you take your images and you randomly masked out like 90% of the pixels at train time? Can you learn an image generator? Where you have you don't know what those things are. It's a very different style of problem. And that's the real world. That's what the real world looks like. The real world is not like a real world. There are lots of real world applications of images where you actually have like high resolution. There are lots of real world applications, but a lot of these other fields, you encounter other kinds of interesting problems that you have to think about that lead you to architectural choices. In the same way, the reason we have convolutional nets and why those were so important is because people were working on images. If no one worked on images, no one would have discovered convolutional neural networks. Convolutional neural networks are a special thing for images, and they reflect that, right? Yeah. And I think that that's kind of the same idea, is by basically finding new kinds of data sets from different domains that have different characteristics, that's going to feed back into new kinds of machine learning architectures and techniques, and maybe not deep learning. Maybe people will discover other kinds of totally new machine learning paradigms. Who knows? But I think that that's going to come out of working on new problems rather than working on the same problems over and over again. And I, you know, these papers, the people, they moved the like decimal, they're like in the fifth decimal place now. Like I went from like 0.00001 to like 0.000. And it's like, is that really interesting? I don't know. Yeah. So, you know, these areas where people are working on totally new kinds of data, those are, I think, the things where we're going to get the most, you know, machine learning innovation.
Yeah. I totally agree that. I think recently I was just checking the MNIST dataset. Like it was a long time I was working on MNIST datasets. So I was just checking like what does the baseline results look like, and I read the paper that was on the top of the baseline, and they had such a complicated architecture. Like it took me around an hour or 1 hour to just realize this thing and right. the improvement.
But you know, most of those techniques can't learn reverse MNIST. That's true. If you reverse the zeros and ones in MNIST, they can't learn it anymore. You know, so it's like you think about the question, I'm not saying that those model systems aren't important. I still fool around with MNIST like once a week. Like there are those things are useful, you know, model systems to try stuff out. But I do think that you want to be inspired by real world problems. And frankly, I think you want to search out the problems where the current techniques aren't working well. If you can find a problem where the current techniques aren't working well, then you found an opportunity to develop something new.
Totally true. And I just want to sign off with a very last question that I normally tend to ask everyone is one of the very, very common questions that I get from students who are getting started into research is they really get interested in machine learning. So like, yes, it's cool. They read blogs that, hey, we can use these things, recommendation algorithms or image object detection, all those things. But they often have like a very confusing, like you said, like you started off when machine learning did not exist, which maybe like just a person deep learning was something that wasn't that much popular. And nowadays, if you see, there are just tons of resources, tons of stuff out there, and like tons of papers. Like I think like even me getting updated to these kind of papers is very hard. So people are lost, as in like, where do I get started? I want to be a machine learning engineer or a researcher, but how do I get started? So what does your advice overall look like? Like as in, if you were to just talk to someone who just recently got interested in machine learning, what kind of avenues would tell he or she, like, what does the path of machine learning look like? Industry, academia, or any, like even for you as a startup founder, what would you tell that person?
Well, I think kind of like what we talked about at the beginning, I'd say start by thinking about an example problem that you actually kind of care about. Like, I think that, you know, choosing just some problem that you can download, like the Iris data set or something like that, I don't think that's helpful. I think you want to find a problem that you kind of want to see it solved. So choose a problem that you actually want to see yourself make progress on. And I think that you want to be coding stuff up from scratch, right? So like very first thing, yeah, you know, we give coding problems to everyone that like applies to Unlearn. So we have people fail. Most people fail, and we give people just a data set of vectors. I don't know, like 100 vectors, and we say you can't use any, you know, standard. You have to code up the algorithm. You can't just use a function. Compute the distance matrix between these vectors. And something like 90% of data science and machine learning applicants fail that. They can't compute a distance matrix. All right. So people are kind of used to today to this idea that like, oh, I should just pull an off-the-shelf function and use a function. And I do see why certainly in some applications that's useful, but you can't do that without understanding what the function does. That's not good. We talk about interpretability and explainability. There's a whole bunch of people who are calling functions that have no idea what that function does, right? Yeah. So I think that like, you know, start off coding that stuff up yourself. Like code up PCA, for example, but don't use an SVD. Okay, how do you solve I used to ask this as a question. How would you do a PCA if you cannot fit anything in memory? Right? There's a few different ways that you do it. But what if your data don't fit in memory? So now you can't just load it all up and say like PCA function. You can't just load it up and do an SVD. What are you going to do? So I think focusing on really understanding the fundamentals of the algorithms, like, and actually how they work, like, how does a linear regression work? Can you code up a linear regression from scratch? Can you code a logistic regression from scratch? Can you do that in full batch? Can you do it in mini batch? Can you code up backprop? code all that stuff up. That's how you should get started. Get a problem and just start coding stuff up and see if you can actually build the fundamental algorithms. If you do that for, you know, the beginning, like if that's what you're focused on, you're going to have, more knowledge after a couple of months than most people who do this. Most people are just calling functions. Don't do that. Don't just call functions. Really learn how these functions work. Code them up yourself. It's like only then, once you understand everything, should you start thinking about how you just use off-the-shelf functions.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think this relates back to, like, I think one of the grad projects that we did was on binary neural networks. And it was like a very published, very nice paper, but the idea was to use that as like implement the back propagation algorithm on ourselves. And I think that was like the most tedious task that we had. And I'm like, me coming from like a master's degree, I thought, hey, why do I want to waste my time on this rather than I would just build the next ResNet 50 or something like a big model.
Yeah.
But fast forward, I was interviewing for some company. And like you said, the person really asked me like a very standard question, like, how do you backpropagate these values? And I was like, damn, like I'm happy because it helps you. And I think that really helped me in understanding instance norm, batch norm, and what exactly goes there. We were stuck on a problem that was biased regression. And I learned that, okay, using instance norm versus batch norm would be like a good solution, like a quick fix to that problem. And I was like, yeah, I'm thankful to learning those skills because it's like, because if you get started into deep learning right now, there are tons of things. So it's easy to miss out these very basic concepts. So yeah, I love your advice on that. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. But yeah, apart from that, thanks a lot. I think those are the only questions. So like, I know we are running out of time, like fairly on a Friday evening. So thanks for hogging that. And thanks for being here. But overall, I think this was a wonderful podcast. I think I can relate a lot more things that you said because I work with a lot of radiologists, physicians, and clinicians every day. So it kind of feels, natural to ask these questions. And yeah, a lot of things, you had some great insights, I think, at least in the interpretability and explainable topics. So yeah, thanks for sharing those things.
It's always important to have controversial opinions.
yeah, that's very true, actually. Yeah, having one line of thought really doesn't help you think more. So those are the few things like we have in lab meetings. Like my professor specifically asks not to, like if she sees I'm trying to argue over there, she actually tries to promote me that, hey, argue. That's how we normally learn. So yeah, I agree to that. But yeah, thanks for being here. I'll leave a link to your blog, to your LinkedIn, and also Unlearn. So like people who are interested more about it, they can figure and maybe reach out to you. Hopefully some of there are candidates who want to work at Unlearn or maybe
I hope
just
they can
get
give you the distance matrix. Yes. Yeah.
yeah. I think I should have that as a description over there. If you're applying for Unlearn,
heads up
what you can expect. But yeah, at least they would learn something new. So that's a good thing. So yeah.
Yeah, but again, thanks very much, Jake. Great chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.